officially start that. Okay, so as you can see, not many people had specific questions, but there was one about how many questions are on the exam, what types of questions are they? So I will try to give a basic answer to those sorts of logistics. So first of all, length. So I'm aiming for a length and time. So we have 75 minutes. I'm aiming to fill that. And my assumption is that for questions with like a less than a sentence answer, that's around 3 minutes. For a multiple choice or true false question, that's 1 to 2, closer to 1 if it's just true false. And for a long question, it's 5 minutes, or for a really long one, maybe more. So this gets us around 25 parts of questions if we assume they're mostly the less than one sentence answer. I hope to have more multiple choice true false just because I like to be able to grade your assignments quickly. Also, they're usually better questions when I think about them enough to actually write out true, false, multiple choice. I hope to have this resume actually reserved till 7 next week. That's not actually confirmed yet, but hopefully won't be a problem. So the idea is I will try to make the exam be what I think fits in 75 minutes and give you until 7 to do it, which hopefully will mean that no one will have time pressure. So any questions about that? And I guess general questions. So short answer questions are basically what I write by default, and multiple choice is what I actually write when I'm thinking a little harder. So there'll be mostly these and a handful of longer questions like write an implementation of this C for under some conditions or something like that. Or something where you have to give a more lengthy explanation than just being able to write like a sentence fragment being enough, which is should usually be the case when I ask for an explanation. As for kinds of questions, I'm trying to not ask ever, what was done in paper X? I'm not going to ask questions like that. I'm not going to say, in the MIPSAR 10,000 paper, how do they do X? That is not going to be the form of any questions. I will set something up saying, suppose we have a processor, and it might be exactly the same as the MIPSAR 10,000. I'm not going to ask you to memorize what happened in each paper. And we're going to focus on conceptual questions. So you should not expect me to ask you to define what a reorder buffer is. I'm going to ask you something about what the reorder buffer does. So please, it's not about memorizing definitions. And I will hopefully be using terms that are familiar to everyone. I don't want to trip anyone up on vocabulary. There might be a few less conceptual, more what will something do questions. But they should be generic enough that you're not going to have to memorize what a particular CPU or reorder buffer design does. If you know how it works, you should be able to figure it out. If we use code, it's either going to be in generic assembly, as in make up an assembly language syntax, or I will make up a simple assembly language syntax that will hopefully be unambiguous and easy to understand, or if you need to write assembly, just make up any syntax that where it's clear what each instruction is and what its destination is. Or in C. But I don't intend to have lots of questions where you write code, because that's really, really hard to grade. And on a related note, I have a, do I have it in? So post linked off Piazza, I have a sample of exam questions I'm not using, which gives you an idea of what sort of exam questions I write. It's not quite representative of the real exam, mostly because all the good multiple choice questions I kept for the real exam. So there aren't as many good ones there, but it gives you an idea of the sorts of things I'm going to ask about. On those questions. And I'd be happy to take questions about those. So as we can see over here, that was the only specific question someone had in advance. Are there any specific questions, very specific things, more specific than these sorts of topic categories that people want me to go over? right now. Yes.
Did what you say about paper also apply to homework? As you won't ask about specific homework problems.
Yeah, I won't ask you. Yeah, I might ask you like, what would an out-of-order processor do? I'm not going to say, what did the Gen 5 processor do when you were running a matrix multiply? I might say, suppose we run some dense linear algebra, some compute-intensive application on an out-of-order processor, what's going to happen? I might ask you that sort of question, but it's not going to be specifically requiring you to remember what happened in the homework. And I'm not going to, for example, require you to remember what the stages of the Gen 5 processor are. If I need to refer to the particular stages of a processor, I will tell you which ones I care about, rather than because they're different between different processors. I'm going to try to avoid things where it matters which one you looked at. Other questions? Specific questions, including like, there's like some technical thing, something about one of these topics very in particular you'd like answered? Okay. So if not, so there's interpreting what topics people want to review is an interesting science. There are a few clear winners. So the biggest one is out of order. So precise exceptions, apparently everyone who answered this survey really wants covered, and registry naming and instruction queues. So I'll probably spend most of my time today talking about those two things. And the other clear winner topic is cache coherency, with a third place going to vector instructions. So that's my interpretation of these results. So if you don't see me mentioning the topic you really care about, I'm sorry, but I think it's pretty clear that these are wanted more. So let's talk about sort of these two aspects of how of out-of-order processing. So how we do precise exceptions and our reorder buffers, which, if you remember, is both our mechanism for exceptions and also is how we can do things like branch prediction. Also about registry naming in general, which is how we deal with dependencies. And I think a good way of conceptualizing this is to remember the pipeline we had in our simulated processor. We have our out-of-order part here, and we're asking about basically what this rename and commit phase do. The two parts that deal with the instruction queue and the reorder buffer, which are where we're going to actually do all the important stuff with respect to arranging so we can execute instructions out of order safely and also handling exceptions correctly. So let's start with register renaming. Oh, that was misformatted. So we start with the motivation, which is that we have conflicts. So here's an example of some code where we want to compute this B here as early as possible for performance. And the reason we want to do that is because we want to use it in this load. And we want to start the load as early as possible in case it takes a long time, so we stall as little as possible. So from a human looking at this perspective, it's really beneficial to execute this B instruction earlier. Doesn't mean that a real processor is going to figure that out, but we like the processor to be able to execute that B instruction earlier. But a problem with that is that if we just execute them in the order BAC, we'll get the wrong answer. So for example, if the values start off 1200, we'll say register 3. So we execute B first, we say register 2 becomes 6, and we'll get, and you can see it's formatting here, you can get, and we'll get 7 for register 3 here, because we execute rather than 3, rather than adding 1 and 2, we'll add 1 and 6. So that's the problem we want to avoid. And it seems like we should be able to avoid this because there's no real dependency between these two instructions. We don't actually, B doesn't actually need to wait for A to compute a value. We aren't using anything A does. We just have this false dependency because we happen to be sharing names. In particular, the name R2. So register renaming is about changing what names we assign in order to get rid of these name conflicts, these cases where we have bad names. And the basic procedure is that we have this renaming map. We have this map between logical, that is mislabeled, wow. Between logical registers and, or architectural registers, registers the user sees, and physical registers, which are I have as X1. And the basic procedure for renaming is we're going to have this map of what name goes to what name, and a free list. We're going to have a list of registers where we don't need the values in that. This means that we have to have extra registers. If we're doing register renaming, we have more registers than appear in the assembly. So we have some initial free list, and what we're going to do is we're going to take registers off this initial free list for each value that's assigned. So this R3, we take X3 off the free list, and it becomes X3. For R2, we take X8 off the free list, and it becomes X8. And for R4, we take X12 off the free list, becomes X12. We just take registers off the free list, and we get some final free list when we're done, and the map updated according, where R3 is now X3, R4 is now X12, and R2 is now X8. And so what happens when we run out of things in our free list? We have a stall. So in our pipeline here, if we run out of things in our free list, rename is just going to stop sending more instructions out because it's not able, doesn't have names to give them. So in renaming, we have these several important data structures that need to be at least conceptually maintained. So we have our current name map, which we update on instruction rename. So every time we rename an instruction, we're updating our current map of what the next instruction we rename should consider the actual registers to use. We also have our free list, which we update on instruction rename, and we also have to put things back on. And that's going to be the job of the commit. One of the jobs of the commit phase is going to be adding things to that free list. We also need to somehow deal with the name map for exceptions. One strategy for this is we could maintain another mapping. A different strategy is we could update our mapping with information we have. I will share the latter strategy because it's what the MIPS R10,000 paper does. But we are in the reorder buffer paper talked about both types of strategies. So let's look at a code example here. So just a simple aspirational code example. And here is an exercise here. So if you don't have paper or some place to write, find a place to write and figure out how does this, given that this state, how does this get renamed? And notice that I've included some instructions from branch prediction because that's what's going to happen in a real processor, is that we're going to predict the loop and start and rename, get at least that far on these instructions after the loop, regardless, even though we haven't actually even renamed the loop yet. Okay, so let's start with, so what do people think the answer is? Let's start with what's the free list end up being? When we're all done doing all this register renaming, what's the state of our register free list? Yeah.
X5, X6, and X7 are removed.
So just X5, X6, and X7. So that's one answer, is that the free list is that X5, X6, and X7 got removed. Any other answers? And X, so that's all that's left. Okay. So you say, so some people think X8 and X9, there's some disagreement about whether they're still around. Any other answers?
Just X11.
And some people only think X11 is around. So there has to be some disagreement here. So why don't we go through step by step? So here's our initial free list. Nothing omitted. 5, x6, 7, x8, x9, x10, x11. So let's start with our first instruction. What are we going to do? What is this going to turn into? Okay, so you one proposal. Does everyone agree with that? And it's X3 gets Emma X0. People are nodding. Okay. So how about the next one?
X5.
So you say that this becomes X1 becomes M of X3, and you say X5 becomes M of X3. So why did you say X5? So let's, to help think about this, let's say that just before these instructions, we renamed this instruction. To X3 get something, because X3 is in our name map, so that's currently what that turned into. And let's look back at our first instruction here, assigning to R3. What's going to happen if I take this renamed instruction here and execute it after our proposal X3 gets M of X0?
Overwrite.
Yeah, we'll overwrite. Yeah, sorry.
Okay. So browser is assuming that was the start of the code, and prior to that, it was not.
So this is before this is our initial map as we're starting to rename this.
Okay.
Since we haven't renamed it yet, we can't have used that name. So every time we write a value, we choose a new name. Because we don't know, because when we're doing the renaming, we don't know what happened before.
Okay.
Right? Unless I've told you what happened before. We don't have information here that tells us what happened before.
While doing the renaming, the processor does have what happened before.
But the rename phase is not looking at it. Where would that information be? In the instruction queue, which is not something we're actually going to look at from the renaming phase, because that would be a lot of extra logic. Like, why bother looking at what instructions we have pending when we can just choose a new name?
Okay.
Right, because that's what we're trying to avoid in the first place by doing registry naming, is looking at what instructions we have pending. So we're not going to do that. We're always going to have to choose a new name just in case something else is using X3 that is already queued. So this leads to some solution like this, where we choose a new name every time. And we end up with the shortest free list, where only X11 remains, because we use a new name every time we assign to a value in a register. We don't use a new name when we assign to a value in memory, because that's named after, that's an address. We don't need to worry about that. That's handled elsewhere. So any questions about this? So, yeah. So it's a mechanical process, and you need to remember every assignment. You don't need to think about it. You're renaming the register. So that's why register renaming is considered so elegant, is because it's pretty simple to implement. So there were prior solutions we didn't talk about in class, one known as scoreboarding, where you had to actually keep track of what instructions you had in flight in order to do this. Do this resolution of false dependencies. And that is what we want to avoid by doing register renaming. So this gives us register renaming, and that's one of the two things that rename phase in the Gen 5 processor was doing. The other thing it was doing, it was just writing to the reorder buffer. So it was responsible for adding entries to the reorder buffer, which we might use later if we have an exception. Or if not, we'll use later to actually commit the instructions. And one of the things that committing is going to do is it's going to make other things go on this free list, which is good because we want to be able to keep renaming instructions and running them. So let's talk about what the reorder buffer might contain. And I'm going to use, yeah.
Can you go back? I disagree with one of your points. The X8 one?
Which one?
X8.
This one?
I have X8 gets X5 minus X2.
X5. Those are flips. The important thing to remember is that you basically just copy the free list into all the assignments. That's what renaming is doing. So the other thing is we need a reorder buffer. And here I've shown the contents of the reorder buffer similar to might exist on a processor that works kind of like the MIPS R10000. So there are multiple traces for what a reorder buffer or similar thing actually contains as far as how you represent the value computed by the instruction. But when we have this register renaming, we're going to have physical register names, and that's how we're going to represent it. And here, bizarrely, we're doing the style of reorder buffer. We don't actually say what the destination register was. That's what the MIPS R10000 does. Instead, we're storing what the previous physical register was for this logical register. So we're saying here, this X5 here, which I'm not storing in the reorder buffer this time, just because I'm not going to do that for handling exceptions, represents R3, this X5, but previously it was X3. So this is the style of reorder buffer where we have the information to undo the operation of the instruction. So the way we undo this instruction here with this information is we just change the mapping to have this previous register. So this is one of the styles of reorder buffers that were talked about in the paper. Perhaps the less straightforward style, but it's a more natural fit to having separate physical registers. So another thing we could have done is we could have stored the actual value here instead of in the physical register, or stored the actual physical register we used, and do some other process where we keep track of the current mapping rather than undoing the mapping with this. So we have a straightforward process where as we're renaming, in addition, we record the result of the renaming in some form. This is one possible form with recording what was previously the name into our reorder buffer. And notice that some instructions like stores don't have a destination in a register. They still have a reorder buffer entry because they can still have exceptions. Any questions before I move on about the contents of this reorder buffer here? Okay. Apparently not yet. So let's say we execute this load here, and we get a fault. This load corresponds to here. So what's going to happen first? So can we just start writing the page fault handler? So think about that and see if you agree with your neighbor about whether we can start writing the page fault handler right now. We've just detected that there's a fault, presumably a page fault, in a load. And this is what our reorder buffer looks like. Yeah, people do not want to talk to their neighbors or don't have neighbors. Okay, but give you some time to think. So who thinks the answer is yes, we're ready? Thinks the answer is no, we're definitely not ready? Who doesn't know? No, or doesn't care? Okay. So let's say we started the page fault handler right now for this instruction. So our first question should be, one question is, have we done everything up to the page fault handler? So as we need, especially for a page fault, we want precise exceptions. We want everything up to where the page fault happened to be done. And if we look at this ready column, it's not. And that's going to mean that if we did a page fault here, we'd be in trouble. That we'd have these values which were supposed to be stored that weren't stored. And if the page fault handler restarted the program right here, we'd be in a place where those values would never be stored, which is not the contract we have about how page faults and other precise exceptions work. So that's the first problem. So first, we're going to wait until all those instructions are actually done. But then we're not done yet, because we need to fix our register map. So we need to advance, we have our current register map, but we need to, first of all, retire all these instructions. We need to commit every instruction up until where the fault is. We need to have entries on this free list. We can't just leave it alone. And the only way things are getting onto our free list is when the commit stage actually processes them. So another reason we couldn't skip these is that we need to actually process all those instructions up to the fault in order for the exception handler to have registers to use. So before we can get to processing this fault, we need to take everything before it and actually add those registers to the free list. So for example, for the A instruction, the previous physical register was X3. So when that instruction actually logically completes, when we commit it, that's when we can add X3 to the free list. because now we're done with X3. We have its value in a different, the value for the corresponding register the assembly programmer uses in a different register. So we process this by adding to the free list here. And we're going to do that all the way down until we get to where the fault is. And then we see that, oh, this is a fault. I'm not going to add that to the free list normally. But we're not done here, because we have a bit of a problem. So we have this other instruction here, which we've executed already. And we've even changed a register because of this instruction. Whatever, we changed X12, where R4 is now pointing now for new instructions. And we need to fix that, because we don't want the page fault handler to see the new value of R4. We want it to see the value that R4 used to have. So what are we going to do to fix that? So what is the commit going to do? Yes?
It'll just roll back at the value of the register was. We'll look at, say, D is R4 to X8. It'll just map R4 back to X4.
Yeah.
Add X8 back to the free list.
Yeah. So it won't add X8 back to the free list, but it will add X12 back to the free list.
Okay, right.
So we're going to say, okay, we're going backwards now, so we'll get rid of this instruction here. Remove it and say it's not in our reorder buffer anymore. But to get rid of it, we need to say, okay, now I've freed up X12, which I was using because I thought we'd go further in our program. And it's really supposed to be X8. And I add X12 to the free list because we don't want to ever not be able to use a register again. And we go back another step and do the same for R1. We change it from adding from X11 to X10 and add X11 to the free list. And this is the way the MIPS-R10000 did it. And notice that we're going backwards. So we have, because that guarantees that if we have the same register appear same logical register appear twice, that we get the mapping that's most recent to the fault handler, closest to the actual exception, not something from later on. We don't see a value from later on. And we also, want to undo the mapping for this because we want to run the page fault handler as if it was just before this instruction executed. Because one of the things that we're going to do with precise exceptions is retry the thing that failed. So we also need to undo this. So any questions about how this looks? So this is a procedure where we have one rename map here. And our reorder buffer is telling us, is remembering how do we go backwards in that mapping? What was the old mapping? And when we're going forwards, we look at what the old mapping was and say, okay, that register is free now. And when we have an exception, we go forwards up to the exception, and then we go backwards from the end to update the mapping in reverse to undo the effects of anything after where the exception occurred that happened. So another question from here is, if this is what my reorder buffer looks like, do I know that I'm going to have a fault on this instruction? Is that the only possible thing which could happen? Well, the answer is no, which is why I'm asking. So what's something else that could happen here? This is what our reorder buffer looks like. What could happen to this program besides a fault happening on this B instruction here?
It had a fault earlier.
Yeah, so one of these earlier instructions that's not done could also have a fault. So it's very important that we process, that we first go in order through these instructions before we actually think we're triggering any exception handler. Because yes, you're triggering some sort of exception handler or something like that, but it might not be the one we think. Another possibility besides a fault is that this here, that's a branch. And this was everything after here is a branch prediction. Just like we could have a fault, say up here, we could have a branch misprediction here, and everything after here in the reorder buffer should never actually happen. And the way we're going to deal with that is exactly the same way we undid the effects before the fault. We're going to go backwards and undo all the mappings for everything after here which happened. And when we do that, we're going to ignore a page fault. Because that instruction wasn't supposed to execute, so as hardware implementers, we're responsible for not making that page fault happen, even though we detected it. Okay, so that's a really important point. So the important point is that normal operation is you go in order and you update that free list. And on exception, you go backwards to undo instructions, undo the current state of that rename map back to where it was. There's some alternate designs for reorder buffers which are equally valid but typically not used, which we saw in the reorder buffer paper. So we could store the current physical register, and instead of updating the map for the latest instruction, we could maintain two maps. One for what happens if we have an exception right now, another for what do I do with the next instruction, but that means you have two maps. There's also some shortcuts, which I won't ask about in the exam, like what the MIPSR 10,000 paper took, where they had, where they stored a copy of the map as of a branch, just to speed up doing it for branches, so they didn't have to go through the reorder buffer on a branch. But you could, but you don't have to do that. You can do the slower way of just going through backwards, instruction by instruction. So any questions about our reorder buffer and precise exceptions? Okay, so let's look at another piece of our that people are commonly asked about, which is how this instruction queue stuff over here works. What does that do? So our instruction queue is where our renamed instructions go. And there, our instruction queue is responsible for figuring out when it can actually run those instructions. So what we're going to have are two data structures. So one is the one I showed in the picture, which is the actual list of instructions. Another is going to be some sort of busy list or busy map, saying what registers actually have values available. So in the Tomasov paper, there wasn't an explicit busy map, but there was tags, and that's how this worked. And you could look up the tag in a register. So this existed in some other form. It's not exactly in this form. Essential idea is we have to know what values are not available right now that we have to wait for. And the basic operation of our instruction queue is every time this list changes, we're going to go through all our instructions and say, what can I start now? And if we look at this busy list, we can say, oh, I need all these names. All these names here in the busy list are used as arguments to the instructions, not things they produce. They're inputs. That means all these instructions that use those values, I can't start right now. So I can't start any instructions with busy inputs yet. So the instruction queue is going to have those instructions, but it's not going to do anything with them. Instead, it's going to look at the instructions which don't have any busy inputs, and it's going to try to start as many of them as possible. How many it can start depends on what functional units are available. But essentially, the normal procedure is that you go through, most simply, just in order, looking to see, do I have a something place I can run a load? If so, okay, let's push that there. Do I have some place I can run an add? Okay, let's push that there. Do I have some place I can run another load? If so, let's push that there. Just go through an order for everything where the operands aren't busy and push those through. And as you do this, you eventually get results from the functional units. So our instruction queue both gets things to the functional unit and needs to deal with the results. So in the Tomoso paper, we have this common data bus where we learned about an instruction finishing, and we got the tag, which in our parlance is the physical register number. So we might learn, for example, that X5 finished. It's no longer on the busy list. So we get that signal. And the instruction queue is going to respond to that signal by saying, okay, X5 just finished, so let's look at what that might have changed. And now let's go through my instructions again and see which ones I can actually run. And just because X5 finished doesn't mean we can run all these instructions. So for example, X6 here is still busy. So X5 may have finished, but we can't start this instruction yet. But this load here, we can start. So we check queues for matches. We also might start instructions which aren't related because we've just freed up a functional unit. So whenever we either free up something from our busy list or free up a functional unit, the instruction queue is just going to say, what isn't busy now? What can I start? And this is the same thing the reservation stations, which were distributed, but it's the same idea. They just only talk to one kind of functional unit, did in the Tomoso paper, that they just constantly look for what instructions can I start now. And they receive updates about when the functional unit is available and when operands might be available. And they have the logic to reply to those by actually starting the instructions. Any questions about this procedure here?
You said that because X5 is no longer busy.
Yeah.
And run the one that you have highlighted green, but that has X6, which is also busy.
It's not an input.
Oh.
So you only look at your inputs. The outputs, you don't care. And because of renaming, you don't need to check them. You don't need to worry. Yeah, because we have renaming, we know that the output, that's the only instruction queue that uses that output. And the output was free before we got it in our queue. So there's absolutely no need to check the outputs. We obviously still need them because we want the result of the instruction written to the right place. Okay, so the other big topic that people wanted some review of was cache coherency. So let's look at sort of our general example of broadcast-based cache coherency. So the simplest kind of cache coherency is this broadcast or bus-based kind where everyone hears about everything going on. And in our most complicated protocol, we have these five states. We have modified, which is our value is in cache is different, and I'm the only one who has it. We have owned, which is a variant of this, where I might not be the only one who has it, or someone else might have a copy. And we have exclusive for the I'm the only one who has it, but it's not changed. I don't need to write it back. Shared, which is our I have a copy and so many other people, but it's the same, but I don't need to do anything. But it's either the same as memory or someone who has it in the own state. And invalid, which is our just default case. And as an exercise, let's say we have one value being cached. So I'm not telling you what's being read and written because there's exactly one thing in memory. And let's go through what the states end up being with that sort of MOSI cache coherency protocol. are each of these CPUs. We have this access pattern. This means CPU 1 reads, CPU 1 writes. And let's assume an invalidation-based protocol. This means that when I write a value, I'm never going to tell another cache the value unless it asks for it. I'm just going to say, hey, I changed the value, and I might invalidate the other cache. And assume we can read from caches or memory, because otherwise it wouldn't make sense to have an own state. So when the cache does a read, if there's another cache which has it, it could read from that cache. And so your exercise is to fill out the rest of this table. And as a hint, one of the columns is really easy. Oh, and evict means that a value is just removed because it's replaced by another value, just because like something else was read.
Can you back to the other definition pages?
Sure. Yeah, briefly. And yeah, if you're reasonably far through, compare your answer with a neighbor if one is convenient. Since this is not a test. You're allowed to talk out loud, by the way. You want to do that? So who has at least the first four done? Minority still. So it looks like, you know, maybe 30% of the class has it mostly done, so it's probably a reasonable time to start explaining. So hopefully most of you have figured out an answer for the first few. So someone want to share what happens on this first read here. So first of all, we know that because everything is invalid, the read has to come from memory. So what state is CPU1 going to go into? So you know CPU1 is going to change state because it better have the value cached right after you read it. That would be pretty annoying if that didn't happen. So what state is CPU1 going to go into? Exclusive. So why exclusive and not shared? So it's the only one that has it, so it logically should go into exclusive. Now, what's our mechanism going to be to actually have that happen on a real processor? What would happen if CPU1 read from the value and someone else did have it instead? How would it know to go into the shared state?
If someone else had a house, if you want to go into shared?
Yeah.
We'd first have to broadcast a request.
Yeah, so remember that this is a, no, I just mentioned it orally, okay. This is a broadcast-based protocol. So everyone sees every read. So CPU1 reads from memory, but it tried to read from all the caches. It sent a read on the bus or some other way of that told everyone about the read. So it knows that no one else replied. That if someone had it, they would have answered. So that's how we can safely go into this exclusive state. That we know that CPU1 sent a message such that if someone else had it, it would know. They would have given the value, or at least given some indication that they had it. So how about this write? What state do we need to go into?
Modified.
So our rule for writing caches, for cache coherency, the most important thing, if you only know one thing about cache coherency, is that only one person can have the value when it's being changed. So that's what this modified state is for, is to make sure that that's the state we're in when we have the value and no one else can have it. I need to go into that state because I'm saying I'm changing this value, no one else is allowed to have it. And in this case, this is entirely local because I can know that no one else has the value and change it from the exclusive state without telling anyone else, because exclusive means I'm the only one. So how about this following right? So what's going to happen? Yeah?
Does 2 get exclusive to it and invalidates the others?
So you say 2 gets exclusive. So then 2, it has to invalidate the others. So our big rule for rights is that if you're writing a value, no one else can have the value. And this is an invalidation-based protocol. We don't update values. So you can't send the new values. So we have to tell them, get rid of it. So 2 is indeed going to invalidate the value, but it's not good, but it's not going to end up in the exclusive state because it's going to write the value. So the value is going to be different than in memory at some point, and because of that, it needs to go into modify. And 2 is going to send the message to invalidate. And when it does that, we can't actually forget this write of 1, so 1's going to say, oh, you're invalidating? Here's my new value. Here's the value I had stored. So this is going to be a whole lot of operations. This is going to be at least, this is going to be sending a copy of the value at least from CPU 1 in addition to CPU 2 sending an invalidate message. So how about when 3 reads a value? So what state should it go into? So can it go into exclusive? No. So it's not going to go into exclusive unless somehow CPU 2 gets rid of its copy. So, and that's not what this protocol wants to do. We have this special state here called owned. And owned exists precisely so we can have a modified value and keep it cached while other people are using it. And this is where we're going to want to use that. So CPU 2 is going to go into that own state. It's not, we're going to avoid writing back to memory because we have the option to do that. If we didn't have an own state, we wouldn't have that option. We'd have to write back to memory. And CPU 3 is going to go into the shared state. It's going to read a value from 2. And because it read it from 2, it's going to know, oh, someone else has this. So it can't go into exclusive. It knows that someone else might have a copy. And the same thing will happen if 1 reads the value. And what happens now if 2 evicts the value it has stored?
Invalidates them all.
So you think it invalidates them all?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So that would be one off. That would be, that's probably more correct. No, it doesn't. Right. So it could invalidate them all. That is correct. It is always correct to invalidate them all, but it is actually not necessary. And the reason it isn't necessary is because in the own state, we know that, yes, other people might have copies, but they're up to date. So we don't need to invalidate the value. We need to update memory. But we don't need to tell everyone to get rid of their copies because they're the same as the thing we're writing to memory. So evicting is just going to write the value to memory. It's not going to tell anyone else to forget a value. So 1 and 3 can still have their values in the shared state, even though the source for their values went away. So what happens now if 3 writes? Yeah, so 3, it's the same as writing from not having the value. It's going to have to invalidate everyone else's copy and go to modified while we have the value and it's not in memory yet. So how about if 3 reads the value it just wrote? So it's still the same. Just reading the value doesn't make it unmodified. We can't go to exclusive, even though they're the only ones who have it, because it's still not the same as memory. But this is entirely local. So any questions about this sort of setup, this procedure for figuring out what the states are in our caches? For this example, I deliberately chose our most complicated protocol. But we could also have the same thing where owned isn't an option, for example, or exclusive isn't an option, or both. Okay. So this is broadcast-based or bus-based cache coherency. And it's that because on this read, we get this exclusive value because everyone else hears about it. And every time we want to invalidate something, we tell everyone about it. So our other option was directory-based. And that's going to mean that we're going to keep track of who potentially has a value. And the way we're going to do this, we're going to have local memories with a directory. And the directory has typically three states, or maybe two states in some protocols. But the most two important are these top two, which are the remote copy, remote invalid, that it's invalid in everyone else's memory. That the local memory might have a copy, local system, but everyone else doesn't have a copy. I don't need to contact anyone else to deal with this value. And remote dirty, which is someone else has a copy, and they might be changing it. So they should have exclusive access to the value. And commonly, but not necessarily, there's a remote shared state which says it might be stored elsewhere, but it's not exclusive. They're not changing it, which is sort of analogous to the shared state we had before. And directories will sometimes have a list of stored locations. So you mentioned that real directories, often for not huge systems, often don't do this, but the most general case is you have a list of everywhere the value is. And the big savings here is that when we have something like this invalidate message here, that we could only, if with the directory, we can know to only send this to CPU1. Rather than spending our time propagating it everywhere, which for a large number of processors is going to be very inconvenient. So let's update our example for directory-based cache coherency. So let's say we have a directory at CPU1. We're going to have the same access pattern. And I've changed one thing. So previously we used an own state between these different processors. But I'm not going to use that anymore because with a directory, we're not going to have the option with the directory protocol I showed you of letting a remote directory have a copy of the thing and not have the real memory be up to date with the states we have. We don't have a state which says it's dirty but not exclusive in the remote caches. We could add that potentially, but the directory protocols we talked about in this class don't have that. So instead of having this own state, we go to share. So the question here is, what are the states of the directory? We have these remote invalid, remote dirty, and remote shared. And the directory exists at once. So this value we're manipulating is in the local memory of CPU1. And this directory is in CPU1's memory controller. And as a simple case, to start out, we're going to be in remote invalid. Because, yeah, one has a copy, but one is the local case. So all the remote copies are invalid. So the exercise here is to fill out the rest of this table. I think it's faster than the existing part of the table. And I'll probably end a little earlier than finishing this just because we're a little short on time. Okay, so let's go through what these states are. So the key way to figure this out is that whenever something happens remotely to one, the state needs to change. And the state's not going to change back except if it needs to. So we start go to remote invalid still, because there's still no remote copy. And then CPU2 does a write. So it's remote dirty, and if we're storing where it is, then we're going to say, oh, it's on 2. And then CPU3 reads, so we need to switch from remote dirty to remote shared. That CPU2 is going to need to update the real memory with a copy in order to, with the directory protocols we know about. And it's going to be shared between CPU2 and 3, so our directory is going to remember that's where the value is, just in case we need to write to it and validate those extra copies. We read again, get more. And what's going to happen here when 2 evicts its copy?
Nothing. 2 is just removed.
So you say 2 gets removed? Any other opinions? So what's most likely going to happen is that it's literally nothing. 2 won't even get removed from this list, most likely, because there's no reason to communicate to have extra network messages happen. If we don't need to communicate, because it's going to still be correct if we contact 2 to invalidate a copy of the value it doesn't have. So usually what our directory protocols will do is just not drop it from the list, unless you actually need to, because hopefully, you know, we'll find out that 2 doesn't have a copy when we actually need to write to this value. Or maybe 2 will read it again, and you know, we won't have done any extra work, really. So typically, we're not going to drop it. There's no reason to drop it. It's correct to have this list of extra things, have as many extra processors as we want. So it's only a matter, so for correctness, it doesn't matter whether or not we do it, and it's certainly less work not to do it, and usually doesn't hurt performance much. So then, if we don't drop 2, when we do this write in 3, we're going to invalidate message to 2 and 1. So one extra message that we needed to send, and one less message than we would have sent if we were using a broadcast-based protocol, because we were not talking to CPU4, which wasn't ever involved. So we still saved, but so we sent 2 invalidate messages to get into this modify state. We're in our remote dirty state again. And this read here, just like it was with the broadcast-based protocol, is again completely low. So that's all I have for today. So the other big topic that people was on the list was sort of vector processors, so we'll do a little bit of that. As a general note, so I could, if people are interested, provide extra office hours this week, if that's a thing you would actually attend. If you don't know, my regular office hours are today 1 to 3, which is a little too late, but also next week 1 to 3, which would not be too late, but that's scary close to the exam if you're doing that. And Friday 10 to noon. But I could potentially schedule some time Wednesday or Thursday if there's strong interest in that. So anyone who would probably attend some office hours that were not at that regular time? No? Okay. You can also email me to schedule an appointment if something comes up. Submit questions you like covered next time, especially if you have specific questions. So general exam studying advice, if you're looking for problems on a topic, a good source is the exercises in our textbook for the chapter in question. They're often a little more depth than I would ask on an exam because you have the book in front of you, but you know, they're a reasonable way to review the topic besides materials I have. And I'd be glad to answer questions about how to do a specific exercise or something on these sample questions I've given. Okay, and that's all I have for today.